This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. News coverage of massive earthquake in Haiti last year filled our eyes with scenes of loss and devastation. And more than a year later, the pictures remain largely the same. Sprawling tent cities shelter thousands in Port-au-Prince. The National Palace is in ruin. And throughout the country, people still clear the rubble with shovels and wheelbarrows. After months of viewing these images, it would be easy to see Haiti as nothing but the sum of its troubles. But the Haitian people have a proud history of independence and a rich artistic tradition that precedes the current tragedy by centuries. Understanding this culture is crucial for those who go to Haiti in hopes of helping the Haitian people. We're talking today with a handful of people who've been working to understand the Haitian people and their needs. We're going to start first with a young woman who has just returned from working as a midwife in Haiti. Raina Galjor joins me now. She's a native of Saxipahaw and works with an organization called Midwives for Haiti. Raina, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
What made you interested in becoming or working as a midwife in Haiti?
In Haiti? Well, I had already been working in El Paso, Texas for 6.5 years, and I really loved where I worked. It's a place called Maternidad La Luz, beautiful birth center, midwifery school right there on the border with Ciudad Juarez. But I was just ready to do something else, change my life.
So you were going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Haiti. How different was it?
Everything is completely different. Everything is completely different. How is it different in what way?
Well, and that's my question to you, really, isn't I want to get a sense of your expectations going in. You wanted mm-hmm. to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know what else you were going to run into when you got to Haiti? Were you ready for what you saw there?
No, I don't think there's a way that anyone could really be ready for if you grow up somewhere like the United States and you're so sheltered from death and seeing suffering and death. I don't think there's any way that you could actually be prepared to see what you see in Haiti. But I did go into it with an attitude of just complete openness, and I really tried to have an attitude of humility. And I think that that really helps walking into a new situation like that. Even with that attitude and with the attitude of accepting whatever the reality was going to be there and wanting that, it was still really hard and really shocking, and the first few months were really excruciating.
What was your training as a midwife?
Before that,
and how did that, once you got to Haiti, how was that experience received? Did people understand what you were trying to do, and are there huge cultural differences that made it difficult for you to apply the training that you had in that environment?
Well, there were a lot of barriers to being able to apply my training to that environment because, number one, I had a language barrier, and my way of doing that was just to immerse myself in the language. I never had a translator. I just was there trying to learn and trying to absorb. So with a language barrier, you can't really do anything. And I felt like my hands were tied. I also felt like it was important for me to step back and kind of just watch what was happening and not arrive telling people what to do. The training that I had in El Paso, I was working with a completely different population of people with completely different risks and complications. I used to have a lot of, you know, postpartum hemorrhage, shoulder dystocia, really bad tears to suture and things like that. And in Haiti, you don't really see those things. So I brought a different skill set to Haiti that has been really useful because I've been able to collaborate with people there and share my skills and learn skills from them. But the things that I see in Haiti are I didn't have a lot of experience with, such as really high blood pressure and preeclampsia. And
describe the conditions that you were working under, the medical conditions.
Huh. Well, we work, we train our students, we train Haitian women to become midwives, and we do our clinical training in a public hospital in Inch, Haiti. It's in the Central Plateau. This public hospital is largely supported by the organization Partners in Health, Paul Farmer's organization. Yet it is extremely devoid of any resources or materials. So we are teaching these women to become midwives and working with them together in this hospital where it's basically like some barns put together with a couple of courtyards in the middle. There's no running water. There's hardly any materials. When somebody needs an IV, you know, sometimes we have the IV fluid, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we have IV tubing, sometimes we don't. We have to go searching for it. Sometimes you're searching for half an hour just to get one needle or one syringe that you need. There's nothing, you don't have materials sitting out on shelves that you can just get. And then what ends up happening is that the people have to go buy things at pharmacies. Their families have to get sent out to go buy the materials or the medications or whatever at a pharmacy on the street. And many times they don't really have the money for that. So the situation that we're working in is a situation where we basically have no materials. I mean, sometimes we have no gloves, literally no gloves, no water.
It's interesting in a way because when we think of midwifery, the one thing we think of is, well, this is the medical need. This is the kind of medical treatment or procedure that doesn't require a lot of medicine and mm-hmm. doesn't require a lot of technology. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you need it standing by.
Well, and that's one of the huge differences with the prior experience that I had, and I think the experience that a lot of American, Canadian midwives have who come down to volunteer with my organization is that midwives are thought of, you know, we do the normal birth and we refer for complications and we do low risk. And in Haiti, there is no low risk. I mean, the midwives are handling everything. I mean, my students are giving blood transfusions and doing stillbirths and, you know, having women have eclamptic seizures in front of them and trying to save their lives. Like, I mean, there's no low risk. Our population is very high risk. And so we do end up using medications a lot of the time.
Your organization obviously does training in this regard, I'm sure in large part because of your experience. How about other midwives and other organizations that you've seen who send help to Haiti? Are they aware of this and do they do that kind of training?
Well, the organization that I work with has been doing training of Haitian midwives since 2006, and I've only been there since 2010, February of 2010. They started doing this training because there was a nurse midwife named Nadine Brunk who went down with somebody who had been going down, this doctor who had been going down for like 20 years or something, and he brought her down and she just saw how many women were dying and she felt compelled to start training Haitian midwives because that's the only way of really getting enough trained birth attendants out there that to save people's lives. I mean, so I don't...
So there is training and it goes on, but for others who come down, are they prepared? If I was trained as a midwife in the United States,
yeah,
would I know how to give transfusions? Would I be ready to do that? And what would happen when I'm out someplace? And
you're not really prepared. There are some midwives who come down who, you know, they've been some, you just never know. Some people come down and they're able to jump into the situation and they're able to accept the situation as it is and help out and figure out ways to use their skills and to help and to teach. But I think most of them feel really paralyzed.
When it comes to training midwives, and you're talking about training Haitian midwives then, and that's part of the goal here. But again, if they're going to be doing these other procedures, more advanced procedures, you need equipment, you need the blood. I mean, you need all the things that we might take for granted up here. How difficult is it for midwives, once you do the training, to actually find what they need to do the job?
Well, people die because we don't have blood.
What give us a sense of the difference between mortality rates, if you know it, in Haiti and the United States, infant mortality and mothers giving
I don't
birth.
Know the exact. I can give you what was given to me, and I don't know how accurate this is, but what I have written down here, which is from the Midwives for Haiti, the newest Midwives for Haiti flyer, is that 1 in 44 women in Haiti will die, it's a 1 in 44 lifetime chance of dying in pregnancy or childbirth, which translates to, 520 per 100,000 versus in the United States, 8 per 100,000. And babies, the infant mortality rate is 48 per 8 per 1,000 versus 6.3 per 1,000. And like I said, I don't really think there's any way of truly knowing the true rate of maternal and infant mortality, because like 76% of women give birth at home out in the country with a traditional birth attendant. And there's no reporting of statistics. There's no one going out there and finding out how many women are dying.
One of the things that you have run into since you've been going to Haiti is the fact that you then host other volunteers who want to come and help. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience.
Well, that's actually become the most challenging part of my life right now. When I first got there, you know, the biggest challenges were just kind of like accepting the reality of Haiti and how hard it is and how poor people are and how how there really are no materials and people literally are dying because there's no oxygen, and, you know, premature babies are dying because we have no simple measures to keep them, to give them what they need for a couple of weeks until they can make it on their own. You know, getting used to the Haitian culture, you know, immersing myself in the hospital, all those things. But right now, I feel like I've come a long way in accepting those things and working in that system. And yeah, I live in the guest house for the volunteer midwives. So I have groups who come down every single week. I pretty much don't ever get a break from that.
Well, but on the other hand, you're doing some good work because you're bringing people in and they're helping out, and somebody's got to do that. And you've got some experience and they want to help. So that's a good thing, I guess.
Huh? It works out sometimes, and sometimes people are able to help, and sometimes they're just paralyzed and reacting to everything that's so different.
How much of that? How many people come down and just can't do it, didn't realize what they're going to do, and become tourists, in effect, and become almost a burden?
Most of them.
Not prepared, and as a result, in the way, to some extent, although with all the best intentions.
Yeah. People come down with really good intentions. Everybody wants to help. I mean, people come down... Some people come down already knowing what they're going to do to help, or already having an idea of what's going to help, which doesn't really help us because they don't really know what we need. Some people come down and they're just willing to do anything and they just go for it, and that's really helpful. Some people come down and they feel helpless and they recognize their own feelings of helplessness and they say, wow, I didn't realize how crazy this would be. I feel unprepared. But they recognize those feelings and they take responsibility for those feelings and they still help to whatever extent they can. And then there's other people who come down who kind of just bulldoze their way through everything.
We'll talk about the variety of volunteers and ways of meeting those challenges. My guest, Raina Galjor, she is a North Carolina native and midwife who spent 18 months working in Haiti. We're talking about Haiti today, just ahead, how Duke University humanities programs can help. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about Haiti, past, present, and future. With me in the studio is Raina Galjor. She works with a group called Midwives for Haiti. And joining us now is Bonnie Elam. She's president of the nonprofit group, The Haiti Connection. Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You've been working and going to Haiti. You've gone there 36 times, right?
Yes.
You recognize some of the frustrations that Raina has been talking
I do.
About?
And we initially had those frustrations also. When I began working down there in 1991, I worked at a hospital in Laogon and came back to Raleigh, realized that there were a lot of people going to Haiti. They did not know one another. So we organized a group that started meeting regularly in Raleigh and organize the Haiti Connection. And we build collaborative projects in Haiti. And it has cut down the frustrations because we've been able to share resources.
How does knowing one another, I mean, I think understanding the Haitian people and culture would help, but how does knowing other volunteers first, how is that helpful?
I'll give you two short stories from when we first organized. When we initially formed our group in 1999 and incorporated in 2000, we had people that would call us to do different things, and we would have phone calls because a missionary had broken their glasses and needed a new pair of glasses. There's a man in Raleigh who's blind and returns to his home in Haiti twice a year. So we would arrange for him to go down and come back with groups that were going or coming, and this got him through the airports, which are very challenging for someone who's visually impaired.
I see. So just knowing what's going on and what the needs are. Has your mission changed or your organization changed since the earthquake?
We had established a lot of networks before the earthquake, and those networks were brought into play and have actually grown exponentially since then. We had a list of 700 organizations that work in healthcare on our website. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services took those 700 and used them as the basis for their contacts in the immediate post-earthquake information systems.
Give us a sense of the kind of work you do.
We build collaborative projects. We go into schools. We've taken 200 computers into schools to help with that. We go into elementary schools that have requested them and that meet our criteria. At the time of the earthquake, people used some of those computers to communicate. About 100 were lost that we want to replace. I, as a physician assistant, goes in. I wear two hats. I wear the Haiti Connection hat and my PA hat. So I will often go on medical teams. I will tell you a story about working at a clinic right after the earthquake. We had set it up in a church in City Soleil. And an older gentleman came in with, or who I thought was an older gentleman, with two young boys, 3 years old and 5 years old. And the three-year-old had a very bad ear infection. And when we talked to him and examined him, we treated the young boy for his ear infection, but we also were told that they were having severe abdominal pain, and it was from the parasites, from the water. And then we started talking with a man, and he was actually their father. And when his house collapsed, he lost his wife, his mother, his sister, and his business. So now he was taking the children every day to work with him, and he was laying block. And so he would take those children with him, and he was losing sleep at night because he was concerned about the children not being in school and being in a situation where they were in the dust and inhaling all of this concrete dust.
Raina was talking about the frustration, too, of people coming down with not quite understanding precisely what they're going to be, or perhaps even vaguely how different this is going to be, and in a sense being in the way. What do you do to prevent that or to cope with that kind of thing?
We have meetings prior to going to Haiti. We strongly recommend that they read several books about Haiti culture and about the situations that they will see there. We also have several people from Haiti on our board of directors and people from Haiti in the local area that come and talk to people. We recommend that they get immunizations, that they go to the CDC website, find out what is going on. We also have contacts in Haiti that they can reach. And we try to prepare people before they go. It's like any new situation. You're never prepared 100%, but we do the best that we can.
Well, part of the problem, I guess, is language. And right now I want to welcome to our conversation Deborah Jensen. Deborah's a professor of French and Romance Studies at Duke University and co-director of Duke's Haiti Lab. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you, Frank.
We talked about language a minute ago, and Duke, in fact, before it sends its volunteers down, can now teach Creole. Tell us about that.
That's right. We had started offering Creole courses at Duke in 2009 with a local Haitian choreographer named Gaspard Lewis. Now we have a professional linguist who teaches Creole at Duke, whose name is Jacques Pierre. And in the Haiti Lab, we're able to put together students' training in language, culture, and a general understanding of some of the most acute debates and problems that surround being involved in Haiti.
And there's some evidence. In fact, I think there was an article that came out today in Duke Today that suggests that this is really beginning to have an impact, because Duke has been sending students. I mean, Duke Engage and other universities are doing this. But there's a sense now that it really is making a difference.
That's right. People are finding that the results of scientific studies, for instance, are just more nuanced, that instead of relying entirely on interpreters, the student researchers are very involved with forming an immediate relationship with the people with whom they're speaking, assessing whether their understanding of what has been said is fully fleshed out, asking more questions when they need more information. And it is changing the degree of sort of sensitivity of scientific engagement. And we also are getting involved as humanities faculty and students on scientific projects where we are able to integrate new kinds of questions into surveys, for instance, so that we've been working on a maternal mortality and a training of traditional birth attendance project. And in that project, we've integrated a whole range of questions that is precisely about people's work, the traditional birth attendants' work in the community, in religious ceremonies, how long they've been in the community, how they became birth attendants. And we're trying to really, in the end, have a much more sort of complete social relationship, so that as we work on actually integrating their services into NGOs and their obstetrics and general OBGYN practices, that we all understand more what is going on.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, that's the stuff of the humanities, understanding culture and cultural difference, cultural sensitivities, not necessarily the stuff of medicine, but the idea that the two work together and that it's now integrated in a questionnaire. Sounds like it could yield some pretty good results.
In general, we've been sort of astounded the way being in a humanities laboratory format at the Franklin Humanities Institute has changed the way that we can conceptualize what the humanities can do. Last year, for instance, when the cholera epidemic broke out, we were puzzled because none of us had ever heard of cholera in Haiti. And we began to do historical research going back to the beginning of the 19th century, looking through newspaper databases and medical writings to try to understand whether there ever had been cholera in Haiti. And that ended up being a large project, and we're going to be publishing an article with our undergraduate student collaborators in the CDC journal Emerging Infectious Diseases. And it's, again, an example of how, as humanists, we've been able to use our curiosities and our skills to try to just flesh out, make more informed the possibilities of engagement.
Well, and there's a digital mapping project that went along with that that showed in fact cholera had not been present before this.
That's right, because in order to understand whether whether there simply weren't sources about cholera in Haiti in the 19th century when there was a great deal of cholera elsewhere in the Caribbean, we ended up having to really gather and sort out information about all of the other Caribbean cholera epidemics. So our digital map is of all of those other epidemics.
So that's interesting. First of all, you've got a humanities lab working with the CDC.
Right.
That's number one and unique in a way. That historical perspective changes our understanding and, in fact, the fact, what we thought we knew about a place. But then ultimately, so what? Why does it change or why is it important for us to understand that this
that
impression?
Historical background?
Yeah, and that this impression that we had of Haiti was wrong.
Right. I think that one of the questions has to do with cultural stigma, that diseases can be viewed as natural to an environment, and it's a product of the way that people see the hierarchy of development in the world. The other thing is that it was important to actually take seriously from early on community statements in Haiti that they believed the cholera had been introduced accidentally through, tragically, international humanitarian and development initiatives, which turns out to have been scientifically validated. And ironically enough, though, it was very hard for the international community to take seriously that Haitians, based on their own observation of patterns of the introduction of illness, were correct on an issue that had to do with the sewage and with asymptomatic illness among people who were working as peacekeepers.
Yeah, it's very important. If you remember back to when those stories first broke, the international community first denied it, and then, of course, the impression is, well, it's another one of those conspiracy theories about, but no, diseases have been introduced by people well-meaning and not so well-meaning.
That's right.
And yeah, our experience on the ground does count for something, and so it's important to have historians involved. I want to ask Raina and Bonnie, when you hear this, you know, and you think about your own training, expectations going in, how much it would have been helpful to you to know the language going in, know a little bit more about the history, and whether these stories resonate with you as practitioners and volunteers.
Makes me kind of just hearing her. Thank you for saying that, because I mean, everyone in Haiti knows that how it started, how cholera started, and we're still dealing with cholera. I mean, there's cholera tents right in front of the hospital where I work. People are still dying. I know a lot of people who have had family members who have been treated for cholera.
And how do Haitians respond to American and foreign aid, foreign workers, foreign help? What's your sense of their impression or their ideas about what's happening?
I think in general, it's kind of become, People expect, I can't really describe it.
Well, yeah, I bet it's conflicted. I mean, I suppose at times people are grateful, at other times suspicious. Bonnie, what's been your experience?
I think it's like the United States. There's some people that do very effective work and they are looked upon favorably. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Haiti Connection has done coming out of the cholera epidemic is we had looked at doing water project prior to the cholera, and it then became in the forefront. And we have made a proposal that is multi-stage, multi-disciplinary. And the initial stage is to take children that are in schools where they get clean water and go home and have contaminated water to make their own container for their home. And we're going to have them make them and decorate them and take them home. And there's also a teaching component. We're going to have puppets. We're going to film it. We're going to have music on the side. The Rotary Club of Raleigh has given us some seed money. And people that are associated with the UNC's Water Institute have also given us some advice.
Deborah, I know that one of the other projects that the lab is working on and is just completed now is a project called History Embedded in Amber. Tell us about it.
That is an artwork that we did with Haitian artist Édouard Duval-Carrier. We just had the sort of unveiling of the permanently installed artwork, which is in the garage space lecture hall of Franklin Humanities Institute. And it's a project in which many different faculty members, graduate students and undergraduate students, as well as some members of a larger community like the novelist Madison Smart Bell, worked on preserving their understandings of both Haiti's immediate earthquake recovery process and of a much longer rich history. And so we used these molds in which we poured resin, and we put photoshopped images and all kinds of decorative items in these resin blocks. And then we also created story blocks to go with them. And it's all colored a sort of amber color. Amber is a mineral, the deposit that one finds on the island of Hispaniola, where Haiti and the Dominican Republic are. And it's been there for millions of years. It often has sort of fossilized traces of the past. And so our idea was, at a time when Haiti's culture was literally sort of pancaked on the ground, that we would also work on this kind of preservation.
And there are these layers of resin, too, mm-hmm. so that there's a layer of resin, then an artifact, and then another layer, which I think suggests the complexity and the layers of a rich history. And you have, and I think what's fascinating about this is that these are undergrads in various disciplines. They're not artists,
right,
necessarily, and they're not interested particularly in cultural affairs and Haiti and history. They come from all sorts of disciplines, and they're engaged in this kind of understanding, very hands-on, and an artistic endeavor.
Yeah, Edouard really managed to get us all very visually engaged, even when we had a fear of art, because a lot of us just had no training or experience in that domain. And people ended up actually fighting for access to the molds. We were all so eager to do our blocks. Even people's children were doing blocks. One of my own sons has a block in this piece. So it was a wonderful experience, and we had a chance to think through larger networks of meaning and connection, like African connections to Haiti, through my colleague Vince Brown and his wife Ajanta's block, which is about an African life symbol.
What's the point, though, of making it an art project rather than, you know, sort of write a paper or a seminar where we can all read, study, and express?
We all really do need to think about representation as a space in which what we can do and what we know is profoundly filtered. And if we're more sensitive to our ability to sort of advance representations to a more nuanced phase, we are likely to be able to do things differently also.
Raina, how have your ideas about the Haitian people changed since you've been down there and been at work?
Well, the longer I stay, the more I enjoy them, because the longer I stay, the more I'm able to communicate with them and speak Creole. And the Haitian people are a very joyous people, just full-hearted, open heart, joyous. And there's kind of a double-edged sword, because they can also be very harsh, mm-hmm. and they're just very blunt, very honest.
Well, how about, and I'm wondering too, it seems to me that you must have gone in, even if you go in with an open mind, you're trying to, you're going down there to help, but there must have been some things, or there may well have been things that were in the zeitgeist here about being primitive, about not being prepared, the lack of infrastructure, and to what extent the people are responsible for that. I mean, was that any part of what you had to deal with when you got there?
like preconceptions.
Preconceptions that were somewhat negative, and maybe you didn't even recognize them until you got there.
I'm sure I had them. I mean, I think anyone who grows up, if you grow up white in the United States, you already have an attitude of privilege and entitlement that you don't even realize that you have, and we all have that, and there's no one who doesn't have that. So it's a process of trying to be open and trying to be humble and just learning from the people there and just taking a step back. Mm. But I definitely, definitely was really upset about a lot of things I saw in the beginning and really frustrated by things I saw at the hospital, you know, the Haitian healthcare workers and how I perceived them.
Bonnie, how about you? What changed for you, or has anything changed?
Many things have changed. It's been a process of evolution, and they will continue to change. The more you know, the more you know. Whether it's a scientific endeavor or whether it's knowing people, we try to engage organizations and groups and individuals in Haiti that are effective and meet with them and listen to them and do what they want. And by doing that, we have also become enriched both in their culture and they in our culture, and find out that we really are very much alike.
On the State of Things today, talking about understanding Haitian culture, my guest this hour, Raina Galjour, she works with Midwives for Haiti. Bonnie Elam is president of the Haitian Connection, a Raleigh-based nonprofit. Deborah Jensen is co-director of the Duke Haiti Lab. Next up, reaching beyond Haiti's troubles through the arts. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about understanding Haiti. My guests are Raina Galjour. She's been working with the group Midwives for Haiti. Bonnie Elam is president of the Raleigh-based nonprofit The Haiti Connection. Deborah Jensen is co-director of Duke University's Haiti Lab. And joining me now by phone is Madison Smart Bell. He's the author of a trilogy of novels that chronicle Haiti's 1791 slave revolution. He also contributed to the panel, at least one panel, to the Haiti Lab project called History Embedded in Amber. Madison, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Tell us why you felt it was important to contribute to that art project.
Various reasons. I've been a big fan of Edouard Duval Carrier for a long time. So just the opportunity to actually, I've also spent a fair amount of time in his studio in Miami, and to get to actually put my hands on one of his projects was not to be refused. But also the concept which Deborah just so brilliantly explained struck me as quite wonderful, and I was able to do a piece that's in a way kind of personal about my relationship to areas in the north of Haiti, and with the possibility of layering these transparencies so that you see things sort of through the filter of one another. I thought it was incredibly great. I mean, the scheme and the template for this is very evocative of the way Haitian culture works.
What did you think about the idea when you heard it of bringing in undergrads from various disciplines to work on this one art project all centered on Haiti?
Oh, well, nobody ever told me about that. No, I didn't. I was only there for a day, so I didn't. I got to meet a lot of people in Haiti Lab, but more like the graduate students and faculty, and not so many of this group of undergrads.
Actually, Madison, there were a lot of undergrads there the day that you visited, actually, and they were completely fascinated by what you had to say about the history of religion in Haiti's literature. Just so you know, you did have that impact.
They just look a lot older, Duke. I think that's probably what you get.
I guess perhaps because they're wiser.
Perhaps. Deborah
is right, because she is right. But let me say that one of the extremely cool things about the Haiti Lab at Duke is that they have they've brought Haitian culture back and adopted it for their own purposes. I'm not sure how conscious they are of that, but one of the curious things about the way Haiti Lab functions is that everybody does a little bit of everything, whether they really are expert on that or not. It's which is very typical of Haitian intellectual life. You have people in five or six academic specialties that are also lawyers and engineers and agronomists, and you have pop musicians becoming president, and you have all this kind of stuff that's kind of unthinkable here. And so, you can have a novelist make visual art, and you can have a lot of other types of, you know, border crossing in DXID lab that would be very difficult to achieve in other environments in the United States.
You wrote last year that the Haitian people have a spiritual resource that is much more difficult to destroy than the buildings they lost in the earthquake. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think they have a religious sense of the world in which, for most people in the first world, there's what Eliot called a dissociation of sensibility, where your sense of the spiritual and your sense of the material are completely divorced from each other and have been for a long time. You may have a spiritual life, but it's almost impossible to get it to have anything to do with your material life. In Haiti, and this is something that's older in humanity than what we have now, the two things are the same. They're completely mingled, they're inseparable, and you don't have this sort of fracture of a sensibility.
Raina, was that something difficult for you to sort of put together when you got there, that the way things were integrated there, that they may not be here?
Spiritually,
yeah.
I mean, I have a lot to learn about Haitian culture and voodoo religion and the way that people see the world and that they view sickness and health and life and all these things. And so, I guess at times it's kind of hard for me to integrate. Like, there was a kid who drowned in the river recently. He was 15 years old, and it's not a very deep river, but he was just crossing the river, and he got carried away. And my fiancé, who's Haitian, was explaining to me how people there perceive that. And his grandmother had said that his father didn't make the sacrifice he should have made to his loi, his God, and she was hoping that if he made the sacrifice within 15 days, that the river spirit would give him back. And that's what people believe, you know, that the river spirit pulled him down. And if the river spirit wants to give him back, it will.
From a cultural studies point of view, that's a wonderful thing to understand how spirituality and day-to-day life are well integrated. Mm-hmm. But Bonnie, I understand that for medical practitioners who are on the ground trying to make a difference, that can also be a frustration. And yet you do have to manage the idea that this is their culture and this mm-hmm. is their – how do you do that? Is that a problem? Does that become a challenge for you?
That has not been a major problem with us. I think rural people that live in rural areas have more of a sense of the supernatural, maybe, than those that we work with in cities and towns. But also there is a sense that God has sent us people to help us with our physical ailments, and that we look at this as a gift from God. And we're very fortunate to be able to provide those services.
Deborah, how does the Haiti lab see itself positioned in sort of coping with this cultural ideas on the one hand, being sensitive on the one hand, and these professional, you know, sort of responsibilities and sensibilities that people from this country might go into Haiti with?
Right. I think that taking one's time to really create new networks of communication is probably the crucial thing, because we may feel sure that we know exactly which approach is more efficient. But over the long run, it's important to really understand all of the different considerations that go into stances on a particular subject, like mental illness, for instance. We have a project on trauma, and we have had a Vodou Ungon, or priest, named Errol Josue, who was just with us last week. And we were talking about Vodou attitudes toward mental illness and the fact that they believe in a sort of changer maladie, or a swapping pathology sort of model, where if someone has a pathology that is affecting their mental outlook and their spiritual outlook, you need to somehow or other get this invested in an animal or the earth or a tree instead, so that the earth can sort of help to absorb that burden. And these kinds of – the more that we understand, I think that the more efficient global health outreach will be.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to sort of embrace that as your methodology.
Right.
But you have to understand that this is how – it's being perceived.
It's important to understand it. We have an undergrad who's working on the history of breastfeeding, attitudes toward breastfeeding in Haiti. It's very complex in the religious environment. there are definitely practices that we would not agree with, as they can often curtail the length of the breastfeeding relationship. And yet, it seems to me that first, just to understand those, to have things in writing so that more global health workers can actually understand local practices is just a crucial first step.
You're also working to study traumatic stress as
That's
well.
Right. Yes, and for that, we're actually working on, although we are administering a PTSD or post-traumatic stress questionnaire and doing qualitative interviews, we're also looking at trauma as it's expressed in religious lyrics and in literary texts. In other words, in just a variety of different discourses and environments. And we are using controversies about PTSD in the American psychiatric environment, in the French psychoanalytic environment, and so on, to help us to kind of open up what trauma may mean in Haiti, what some of the best ways to approach it are. It's clear that in Haiti, the exact same model of PTSD that the U.S. uses with returning military soldiers, for instance, is not necessarily going to work in the same ways. And so we are trying to really understand everything that we can about Haiti's own history of approaching trauma religiously, clinically. It happens, we've learned that Haiti was actually on the forefront of the whole field of ethnopsychiatry earlier in the century, for instance, that they believed in a kind of comparative psychiatry that was extremely anthropologically advanced. So we are working on understanding the whole field.
And that is that the history of a people will play a great, will have an enormous impact on the individuals within that culture and the way they perceive the world. And
That's
so
right.
your treatments and your procedures are going to be different. Madison, I know that you care a lot about the history of Haiti, and we don't know so much about it, particularly the slave revolution. Tell us a little bit about the history, things we should know and their importance.
How long do I get for this? I'm always.
You've only written three novels that deal with the.
Let me try to explain why this is important to us. In 1776, most Americans have heard something about that year. There was a tax rebellion in a British colony that created this country. In 1789, in France, there was a real class revolution that reversed the pre-existing order of things in France. In the French colony of Saint-Domingue, African slaves looked at these two other revolutions that were saying people have a natural right to freedom, pursuit of happiness, equality, and brotherhood, and they said, well, that sounds good. These white people are not including us. Let's include ourselves by any means necessary. And that's what became the Haitian Revolution, where it's the only case ever where slaves out of Africa overthrew slavery by a force of their own arms and created a new nation. So for my money, it is the most significant event of the three.
And it also suggests something and maybe overturns some of our thinking about enslaved people everywhere, but in particular in Haiti, the idea that we weren't aware of what's going on. There wasn't much aspiration for freedom. There was powerful aspiration and awareness that they were should somehow be included in this new idea and new order that was sweeping Europe.
Yes, and in spite of enormous efforts to suppress and silence it, both in Saint-Domingue before that revolution, and then especially in this country, in the slave-holding parts of this country, which, by the way, I happen to hail from, and where Duke's Haiti Lab is also located, there was a tremendous effort to just keep that news away from the enslaved population, but it never entirely worked, and there were people who knew about it, and there were people who worked toward a revolution of that kind here, but the conditions in the United States for a successful slave revolution were far less favorable, so it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, the Haiti Lab has been up and running for a full year now. What's on the agenda for the next year?
One of our big projects right now is called the Slave Nations Project, and we're using a Canadian database of ads for runaway slaves from colonial Haiti. in which the slave owners gave incredibly detailed descriptions of their runaway slaves so that other people would turn them in. And using this searchable database, we are studying all of the different descriptions of ethnic backgrounds from Central and West Africa. And we're trying to really trace the community networks and even things like the health conditions, the visible health conditions that slaves were dealing with in their lives in Saint-Domingue. And so we have many different students who are culling this database, who are transcribing materials, and we're working with a colleague, Victoria Sabo, on another digital mapping project. And so, again, we think that the past and the present are very complementary fields of study.
Raina, you're going back in just a couple of weeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to prepare for this transition?
I'm looking forward to going back. Mm-hmm. I miss it a lot. It's been hard being here. It's always hard kind of being in one world or the other because they're so different. And the transition is a little bit hard when you first arrive either place, but I think I'll be kissing the ground when I get back.
Do you bring anything back with you when you come back to this country after having been there?
Mm-hmm.
So how have your ideas about this place changed, the place where you grew up?
Well, even when I was living in El Paso and I would come back, I would feel kind of out of place. And yeah, living in Haiti and seeing the reality that exists there, coming back here, I mean, it's just completely different. I can't even believe how nice everything is here and how well people live and how much people take for granted. And one thing that really strikes me that I've been feeling pretty sad about recently is just the reality of segregation and how we're still living in a very segregated place. And people don't mix too much. And geographically, there's certain lines that you cross. And yeah. That feels pretty sad.
Yeah, going backwards these days. Bonnie, what projects is the Haiti Connection most focused on right now?
We're focused on the water because we realize that children that have parasites are sick. One out of every five children in Haiti dies before age five. And most of that is from water contamination. And so we're focused on that both from the medical aspect, but also from the educational aspect, because children who are sick do not learn well.
Yep.
And that's where it initiated with administrators at a school where we had put computers, and they asked us to come in and get clean water for the children for their homes.
These are Haitian administrators?
Yes.
Who had, mm-hmm. And how much of that do you do? How many of your projects come from the ground up, people asking you for help in particular areas?
We try to make every one of our projects that way. We go to meetings with Haitian people that are involved in education and in medical care. We go to conferences. We have our own annual conference. So there's a lot of interaction, a lot of networking, and we listen.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today, and I hope there were some ears that were opened and listening today as well. Bonnie Elam is president of the Raleigh-based nonprofit, The Haiti Connection. Raina Geljor is a midwife who will return to Haiti in a few weeks. And before she goes, you can hear her talk about her work and about Haiti at two events. She's going to be at Saxipahaw Ballroom Wednesday at 6 o'clock and again at Carmel Mall September 24th at 4 o'clock. Deborah Jensen was with us, co-director of Duke University's Haiti Lab and a professor of French and Romance Studies. And Madison Smart Bell is the author of a trilogy of books set in the time of Haiti's slave revolution. And the stone that the builder refused, I think, is the latest. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.